It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The Phileas Club is made possible by its patrons. There is one way to support the show, and that's to become a member at patreon.com/thePhileasClub. You decide how much you give, and you decide when you stop. You are in control the whole way. It helps the show enormously, even throwing a buck our way. That is why the show can exist. That is why I can do what I do. So thank you a million to all the people who do support it, and thank you a million to you if you consider giving a little bit. Again, the show is in the link is in the show notes. It takes about a minute and a half, maybe two, to subscribe, and it will make my day. So if you want to make my day, go to that link. Thank you very much. Hey everyone, this is the Phileas Club number 142. We are in February 2020, and we're talking about the virus, the election, and much more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. In this show, do you know what you do? But what we do, we get people from different parts of the world, and we talk about stuff, and we listen to each other, even though we might disagree sometimes. That is a novel idea, which I've been trying to promote for a while now, and hopefully you enjoy it, and that's why you listen. My name is Patrick Béja, and today I am joined by two wonderful guests. On one side of the ring, no, it's not a ring. It's just a table, a coffee table with snacks
round
and
table.
Drinks. Yes, there you go.
These snacks are really good.
Well, I am French, after all.
There is that.
So on that side is the returning Franco from Peru, who's actually in France right now. Franco, how's it going? Yeah. It's been forever.
Yeah, it's been like a long time. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. So it's been good. A lot of things. A lot of work, I guess. But now I have more work, even because I'm split between three cities. So I don't have much time. But it's always good to be here.
So do you feel Peruvian still very much, even though you're traveling so much?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, okay. It's I guess it's just the proudness of coming from Peru. I don't know. It's I've oftenly mistaken by Italian here in Toulouse because there's many Italians, and I guess I speak French as an Italian or something.
Your accent does sound a little bit Italian. That's true.
So I'm learning Italian actually. So now I can actually answer in Italian when somebody asks.
And you can tell them in Italian, no, I'm Peruvian. So
exactly, yeah.
Okay, that's great. The reverse culture shock is when you really suddenly feel like you've changed. It's when you go back for a period of time. Although I'm sure you've gone back, but
in fact, I go to Peru like twice a year at least. Mm. And now that I have kind of a Spanish accent because of living in Spain so much, if I take a taxi, they often assume I'm Spanish, for example.
Oh, and charge you extra or something, or take the wrong one.
Well, no, I know how to negotiate my tariffs. That I haven't forget, but just because of the accent, it's just a thing that happens. I mean, I don't mind it. It's just a result of having lived somewhere else. It's part of who I am, I guess.
On the other side of the snack-ridden coffee table is Alex from Atlanta, an original real-life Atlantan. How are you doing, sir?
Yes, native Atlantan. There are very few of us. Well, Atlantan, as people from Atlanta will say, well, he's from Duluth. There's no, you know, you can't call that Atlanta. But yes, native Georgian Atlanta, grew up in the Atlanta suburbs.
Wonderful. And can you tell us a little bit about yourself, since it's the first time you join us? And there is one key element of your personality and, I guess, character that will define you forever on this show.
Sure.
You're tall. Right. And, you're tall. That's what it is.
That's it. It's that I'm tall, because everyone knows that on podcasts, that's important. Mm-hmm. I am, let's see, the child of two entrepreneurs, two conservative entrepreneurs. I guess that's the defining aspect that will define me forever. And, I'll never be able to get away from it. I too lean conservative, specifically on policies. I lean probably more liberal on social policies. They don't really have a word for that in America, unfortunately. But you can call me an East Coast conservative.
East Coast conservative. Excellent. And, you know, I was saying that in jest. Obviously, there's more to you than just your political leanings. Is there anything else? I don't know. Anything else you want to add?
Well, I guess a little bit more. I am a strength coach as well. I coach people who are over 50, because as we age, everyone, people who are, over 30 are going to know this more than anyone. But as you age, you get, things start to break down. And if you work to continuously prevent that, if you try to get stronger and stay fit, then you can actually prevent a lot of the age-related degeneration that's going on. So that's sort of my field and what I do. I'm a starting strength coach for anyone who knows what that is.
Damn it, I need your help so bad.
Now I'm curious, are we all entrepreneurs in this panel or something? Because
I guess we are, yeah. it's funny.
Great.
I don't really
now
consider
we're
myself.
This is going to be a terrible podcast.
I don't really consider myself an entrepreneur, though. I guess I am, technically.
You definitely.
But yeah. Well, but I don't.
Since you founded a company, I guess that'd be. Once you found a company, you just become an entrepreneur by default, I guess.
Yeah, automatically.
Even if it fails, you'll be an entrepreneur all your life.
Yep. You can never get away from it, just like me being labeled a conservative.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess three entrepreneurs, that's the bias of this show. But there's another thing that we have in common, I suppose, is that we're hearing a lot about the coronavirus. That might be something that the whole world has in common. But really, when I was looking at the news, there are a few tidbits here and there, the news from France and even from Finland. The main thing is definitely that. And I think I mentioned last episode that it was, or the last episode, last regular episode, that it was the main topic, but that it was being handled with relative level-headedness. And I think it's still the case. There's a lot of uncertainty about how the virus works and how much it will spread, and the fact that, I guess, epidemiologists are now saying, containment is, that's it. That's, it's not, we're not going to contain it. So it's going to be a pandemic. So we have to deal with that fact/issue now. So, but in that context, I think France is approaching it relatively reasonably and saying there are things you need to do, but don't panic. It's not going to be like the Black Plague. So I guess that's the main takeaway I take from the French media. I don't know, Franco, do you agree?
The government trying to prevent it from spreading? You mean doing a good job communicating, or the government doing a good job like preventing the
I think
contagion?
In general, the overall reaction from the media and the government is reasonable. There is a certain sense of urgency, but there isn't like actively stoking the fire of panic by anyone, since it's not warranted, right? It's still a flu, which is a bad flu, and we don't know a lot about it, so it might be worse than we think, but it's not like it's significant. It's not anecdotal, it's not like a joke. It is killing people. But it's not something that you should uproot your life for trying to fight and to avoid. It's just It's still just a flu. And the media and the government are communicating in a way that reflects that reality, I feel. There isn't, as some might expect in the media, in the 24 hours news media, especially the artificial manufacturing of panic and that kind of thing. Do you agree, Franco? Since you're in France, I guess you have a little bit of that sentiment as well. But
yeah, I mean, I've seen the now in university where I'm working now, I've seen panels showing what to do in terms of prevention, and I would guess, I mean, on the same time, I don't know what's the correct measure myself personally, in terms of being completely paranoid and measured. So it's hard for me to tell if. I'm not saying it's about they're doing it poorly. I'm just saying that I for me, it's really hard to tell what's the good measure of communication and work they need to do.
Right, but so, would you agree that they're not inciting panic, whether or not it's warranted? Maybe we should all be panicking.
I agree with that in the sense. There's no incitation of panic. Although I've heard there's some football matches that have been not cancelled, but they've just taken all the public, and so they were just played without public. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it was in France.
There's some measures, and of course we've seen major trade shows cancelled or people deciding just, not to go.
For example, that's like last week I had a congress in France, and it just went without any issue. I mean, nobody. I didn't see anyone with a mask or anything, and I didn't see anything weird or anything. There was not even any communication in terms of prevention, which I don't think it was necessary. Yeah. But I mean, I'm guessing, and as this congress went along in Montpellier last week, I'm guessing many events are working as normal.
Yeah, that's how it feels like. Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
Sorry, I'm showing my ignorance here. Are there confirmed cases in France right now?
Yes,
a few, I think. Ooh. Yeah, about 10.
Okay, understood.
Something like that.
I think there's one person who died, which was not French. I mean, someone who came to France and died in France, I think. Not sure if there's more, but at least that.
And the thing is...
Nothing compared to Italy, but...
Yeah, which, sounding Italian, is not such a good deal right now for you, Franco, I guess. But the thing is, the Minister of Health has said in France, he has said... Listen, the pandemic is going to happen now. Like the spread of the flu is going to happen in France as well. It's just a question of when. Hopefully we delay it a little bit so that it's, you know, it doesn't hit everyone at the same time. But it's going to happen. And that's the general attitude I see towards it. It's like, it's going to happen. It's not going to be horrible. I mean, yes, it's going to be horrible because some people are going to die. But again, people die every day. It's not like just wash your hands a lot. Use disinfectant like Purell type stuff. Don't touch your face as much as you can. Avoid it. And that's it. That's the state of things. And it feels like it's not people trying to dull the population into a false sense of security when the world is actually ending. It's just people being responsible in the response to that crisis. But Alex, how about you? When we said, yes, there are confirmed cases in France, you went, oh, like, did you?
Well,
how's the feeling there?
I am fortunate to be in a state where there are no confirmed cases currently. But goodness knows that if you happen to look Asian and you're in at least my neck of the woods, don't sneeze, don't cough, whatever you do, because there's a whole bunch of pretty ignorant people who are going to, you know, start moving away and screaming maybe and carrying on and all this kind of stuff. I think that, you know, news media being what it is in America, it's been kind of a hot topic, and there's been a lot of fear mongering about, as you say, a virus that does, I believe, I'm not an expert in any of this stuff.
None of us are, no worries.
Yeah. From what I've heard, it does have a higher kill rate than the flu, but people comparing it to the Black Death had like an over 50% kill rate. So
it's not quite. it's a higher death rate, and it's significantly higher. But also, we don't know, you know, who it affects. I think the latest I've heard is like older men who have older diabetes are more prone to, you know, being like, it's this kind of category. But of course, it's still very, very new and very young, so things might change. But at this stage, it's that kind of thing. So did you say about the media? Are you saying that the media is like not inciting panic, but making it sound a little bit more urgent than maybe it is? Or what's your feeling about the way it's being communicated by the media and maybe even by the government as well?
I think that the government does a pretty good job, has been doing a pretty good job, at least in my neck of the woods. You know, we're really close to the CDC, and I have clients who work for the CDC, and they've all been sort of messaging the same thing that you're talking about in France. But I will say that the corporate media does not seem to be messaging that at the, you know, lower kill rate or anything like that, compared to what they're messaging of, oh God, there's another confirmed case here. You know, I just read even something in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is it's usually more level-headed, but even them, they said, they had a line that said, there are no confirmed cases in Georgia, but, right, and then 14 people, and then this big paragraph about how 14 people have been quarantined, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it's one of those, they ride right through the unsexy news, and then they, you know, try to get you to watch a little more.
Yeah, that's
hear more about how the coronavirus might kill your grandchildren after this commercial break.
Yeah, it's, I mean, again, I'm not, that's what it feels like to me, and Franco, you're confirming it. So it seems that we're a little bit more reasonable in France, but also I don't watch like the 24 hours news networks, so maybe that's where the panic is happening. But yeah, it still doesn't.
Although I think I remember seeing a screenshot of a online French newspaper. I don't remember even which one, with something that could be interpreted as exaggeration, saying like there's three cases, and the paragraph below it was like, well, three cases have been confirmed that they are not, you know.
So
it's like not, I don't know, it's a play of words.
I'm sure,
like,
yeah,
okay,
I'm sure it happens.
You click and then you see it was not even the case. But
right.
I guess
the
it's just less.
Clickbait is
universal.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So
although,
I guess.
Yeah, I have to add. Yeah, with respect to Peru, for example, I was just to confirm. I was opening the map to see in the infection. So in Latin America, there's no confirmed infections as of, I don't know, day before. And I received
there's nothing south of the border, it looks like, south of Mexico.
Yeah.
South of the U.S.
I guess we're not as integrated with Asia in general, right?
Yeah,
I guess not.
But the thing is, I received a message from my mother like some days ago saying something like, a message, you know, those things you just forward through WhatsApp saying like things to get to take into account to not contagious yourself or something. And I was like, why do you send me this? In Peru, there's not even confirmed cases. and I said it without even really knowing. And she asked me, and she answered me, no, there is. But there isn't. So I'm guessing she got it from somewhere else.
So she thought there were cases.
So apparently, even if the media, I mean, I don't think the media did lied, but I guess things like this can always, I don't know, be generated via social media, or someone decides there's read something, communicates to someone else. And in a way, you get the impression that there is when there's not, you know?
So there isn't, but your mom thought there was for some reason, and you're not sure why.
Exactly. Maybe there was someone suspected to be, but then they confirmed that the person wasn't. I don't know. Or did just someone decided to start inventing things? I don't know. But it can happen, I guess.
I guess.
Especially through WhatsApp groups. Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's WhatsApp groups in Peru that are the vector for these kinds of things, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah.
It would be interesting to compare.
They are vector for any different, any, you know, false information or non-disinformation in general. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So well, there you go. I guess the bad mark on this. On this point goes to the American 24 hours media, which again is never Rarely good rightfully, for anything. Yeah.
Rightfully earned.
How about the rest of what's happening in America, Alex? Is what's making the news and the rounds and everything?
Sure. So the biggest thing across all the news media right now is the shocking realization that Bernie Sanders is not a phenomenon. He is actually a somewhat of a movement, you know, making his rounds, winning Nevada and what could be called a landslide, from what I understand, and then moving on to South Carolina.
So I understand, is he like, he was kind of an outsider, like the weird communist quote unquote dude in the Democratic Party? Are you saying that he's in the lead or getting near the lead now?
Yeah, from what I understand, he has the most he is the front runner. He has the most delegates.
Wow,
he's on.
Okay.
He's I believe he's on top of national polls. You know, he is the current front runner. He was tied for front runner with Pete Buttigieg, who's a more moderate, younger candidate. He won Nevada, and Pete Buttigieg was not. I don't think he ever got to viability, and it's not worth talking about how they do that. But basically, Pete Buttigieg didn't get any delegates, and Sanders got a bunch. So he is currently the front runner in the mystery space points that we judge Democratic candidates by.
So how likely is it that he will remain in that position? You know, or is it like something that could go all the way to the end of the primary? Or is it something that, given what states it's being held at what time, is probably going to erode?
You know, that's the $1 million question. And it's one of those things that I think everyone's going to have their own opinion about. But I can definitely say that when this election started, I bet a friend $100, and I think I'm going to get that $100, that Sanders would win the Democratic nomination. You know, if you look at what happened in 2016, the way Donald Trump won the nomination to the to be the Republican candidate, you see the exact same thing that Bernie Sanders is doing now, reductively anyway. You see that, you know, there were a bunch of people nipping at each other's heels and biting each other's heads off and all this kind of stuff. And Donald Trump was there with just 30% of the Republican vote, but he kept that 30% the entire time through. And everyone else was sort of trying to ride the same lane and, you know, butting each other out and destroying sabotaging each other's campaigns. And Donald Trump was riding in a totally different lane, free and clear, and sort of just drove right past everyone.
And so you guess that's what's going to happen. What do you think of, I mean, possibly, what do you think about Sanders? How do you view him? Because, again, my feeling is that many Americans, if not most Americans, see him as so far left that he's dangerous, dare I say. Obviously not all the people voting for him, but they're a little bit wary of his politics. They see him very much to the left. And from what I understand, he feels like he would be to the left even in Europe, which for America is like he's essentially Satan. Is what I understand, but what do you think
about right? Yeah. So that's pretty much how he is viewed among I'd say the majority of conservatives, or at least conservatives over the age of probably 50 in my neck of the woods. You know, I can't speak for all of America, but I guess I am right now.
yes, please.
That's what we do in this show.
Exactly.
You represent the whole country.
You've got a lot of single issue voters in that demographic, people who are over 50, and especially in my neck of the woods, where it's a higher income level. These people have their entire retirement tied up in, you know, investments, and the economy is really their single issue now. Now you have the other votes, the evangelical vote, single issue abortion, and all of this complications. But you have a ton of people who are just looking at the economy and saying it is good now. Don't screw anything up. And that's, you know, one of the primary reasons they're voting for Donald Trump. Or they will vote for Donald Trump in the election, no matter who the Democratic candidate is.
We did acknowledge it a few times, but I think we should acknowledge it now. For all the issues that many people have with Donald Trump, and I would say justifiably so, the economy in the U.S. is doing really well. Now, some people will say, as always, you know, it's the previous administration's doing and it's the blah, blah, blah. Sure. No matter what, he didn't wreck the economy, and that is something to be noted. The U.S. is doing well, and that's
well. So far, I mean, if you add the trade conflict with China and the coronavirus epidemic, who knows?
Well, I mean, I don't think we can pin the virus epidemic on him.
It's not his fault, but maybe it's not his merit that the economy is doing good either. I mean, and people don't care if it's really the president's fault.
Make the argument that the trade war with China has caused a lot of supply chains to change their routes so that they're trading with other partners who are then not coronavirus spreading, you know, virus through their people traveling from that that country. So
we could argue about all of this. I would say that Franco's reaction is the reaction I was kind of alluding to, which is probably a left-leaning person's reaction, which honestly would be my reaction as well. But for the sake of just neutrality, I think it's fair to note that the economy, when he was elected, and I don't want to make all of this about Trump, but when he was elected, I'm pretty sure that everyone who didn't like it, everyone in the world who didn't like it, including me, who didn't like him, including me, were saying, well, there you go. You put a clown in the White House, and now the country is going to be toast. Like, this was, and the initial catastrophic coming and going in the White House and the staff, you know, leaving. Like, it seemed like it was run really badly. And we were certain, I'll speak maybe in slightly general terms, we were certain that he was going to wreck things, at least to a little extent.
I would argue that most people were hoping, not only just certain, but eager to see that they were, that he was going to wreck things.
And
it's possible,
And I would say, I'll just say this one thing. I'm not sure how much of the economy not being wrecked is his doing as well. I understand.
Oh,
but
almost
it
none.
Doesn't
I'm sure,
matter.
I'm certain of it.
Well, there's the tax break that could definitely help.
Yeah,
that could definitely have juiced up. But really, I mean, Patrick, you're exactly right. That the president has almost nothing to do with the economy, and especially for a sitting president, the economy is the only thing that matters for getting reelected. It makes absolutely no sense. But that's how it has been as long as I've been alive, anyway.
And again, we're saying, you know, he has nothing to do with the economy. I'm pretty sure that if you ask the same people how much, you know, Obama or Bush or Clinton, depending on your camp, if they're responsible for the country doing well, they will say, yes, of course, obviously, you know, he's the president. So anyway,
Obama did great for the economy, or no, he was the worst thing that ever. And there is some of that that's true. I mean, I know that. I don't know about the economy at large, but I know that certainly with the advent of Obamacare, certainly my parents and many of my clients ended up paying thousands, tens of thousands, sometimes more dollars in health insurance than they would have otherwise prior to that legislation. So there's definitely aspects of that that are, you know, that are wounds.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, let's not get into Obamacare. We would be here all day.
Sure.
But because I really want to, but I won't. But all right, so let's go back to Sanders. We were saying he feels like essentially Satan, and you're saying that for a lot of older, senior conservatives, they are very, very wary of him potentially becoming. So I guess one argument is if he is the Democratic candidate, you alienate a number of potential swing votes who might lean conservative and who might dislike Trump and might go vote Democrat, but not for Sanders because he's so quote unquote extreme.
Because he's not because he's not an establishment Democrat. Right. And I have heard that a lot, and I don't really believe it because the same exact argument was levied at Trump. And that was not the case, you know. I think that in if the Democratic Party does want to win this, if you're just looking at like a horse race, if the Democratic Party does want to win this election, they have to do something different, because they, you know, they ran a strong establishment candidate last time, and she lost, Donald Trump. So I think that probably Sanders is the best chance they have of doing the impossible, which is unseating a sitting president in a good economy. That is, I don't know that that's happened in the last, certainly in the last 30 years.
It certainly seems that it requires some kind of a Hail Mary or trying something different. And Sanders, I feel like, again, that is empirical, and it's just my sentiment, but I feel that there's a little bit more awareness of the issues of capitalism. And I say this as a big fan of capitalism and someone who defends it against pretty ignorant critics in France very often, basically ignoring all the good that capitalism has done over the past, God knows, 200 years, but certainly 50 years, or, you know, after the war. But there's this, you know, this meme, which is late stage capitalism and all the problems it creates. And those, I think it's, you know, for all the good that the system does, it also can be improved. And there are issues, serious issues that it creates. And those are more visible than they were before, I feel. And more people are understanding that aspect than even 4 years ago when Trump was elected. So I feel like the wind behind the sails of Sanders might be that sentiment that it's kind of, it goes hand in hand with the climate change issues and how much more, not visible, but how much more aware people are of the fact that this is an issue. And I wonder if Sanders was a little bit early 4 years ago, but now it's like he's talking about problems that people understand are real and not just like the fantasy of an old left-leaning dude who rants sometimes at clouds. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think it's rare the person who doesn't admit that there is a problem with the way that the American dream is sold, and then the way that the American dream actually works out. I think that everyone in my camp, if you want to call it a camp, everyone on the in the conservative party, at least those who are entrepreneurs, who did, you know, sort of build what they have, everyone wants that for any person living in especially their community, but living in America, right? Everyone thinks that, at least in my neck of the woods, thinks that if you work hard and, you know, persevere, you should be able to rise yourself out of any socioeconomic class or wherever you were born and get to where you want to go. You know, that is unanimous. I think the place
is that, Alex, sorry, is that unanimous in terms of goal or objective, which I understand it is, or is it still unanimous in terms of thinking that it's still the case that
that's where the disagreement is? I think that a lot of people, you know, people who live in a lily white area of even like Georgia, you know, Georgia is still fairly segregated class-wise, in that, you know, or Atlanta is rather, that, you know, if you go to certain pockets of Atlanta, you would think that the only people who inhabit there have white skin, drive Maseratis or drive Mercedes and all this kind of stuff. And if you went to certain parts of other parts of Atlanta, you would think that there wasn't a white person around and that, you know, it was a very, you know, it was a hard to do city and these kind of things, right? It's very much pockets of each. And so if some person grows up in, you know, Sandy Springs and they are exposed to high income and they don't really see the inequality, it's very easy for them to say, No, I got a job at a bakery, and I, you know, worked at that bakery, and I learned how to bake, and then I started my own bakery, and I, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And what they don't realize is they were able to do that because they were, you know, their father got them that job, and then they were also in a really affluent area, and so they had a lot of customers who wanted their really good product and all this kind of stuff. They don't see that.
Yeah. So it there is this. But so, yeah, let's go back to the concern that it isn't necessarily like the issues with capitalism. People agree there are some, but relating mm-hmm. to Sanders, they might say, yeah, sure, it's not perfect, but that guy's cuckoo.
Yeah, I had a
go ahead.
No, I had a question regarding Sanders for Alexis. And mm-hmm. do you think that Sanders has moved the Democrats to the left in that sense? I mean, has his policies of what he or what he proposes has made other candidates also try to, you know, imitate as Donald Trump did with the Republicans, in the sense that he just make them appeal to the Republican base in terms of immigration or whatever you name it? And is it your opinion that the Democrats have in a way turned more left than before just to try to compete with Sanders or because of Sanders?
Franco, I think you nailed it when you compared it to Donald Trump, and that I don't think he did anything. I think he saw an opportunity and capitalized on it, just like Donald Trump did in the 2016 election. I think that the Democratic Party was already moving that direction. Because of the growing inequality in America, you have an enormous base of people who are not making as much money as their parents were by half. And they grew up in certain circumstances or they grew up with friends who are in certain circumstances, and they are unable to reach those circumstances. And they feel like they have been, you know, cheated out of the American dream, and the sort of the evil empire is the billionaires of the world who are amassing wealth and not, you know, high CEOs with $14 million pay per year. And they're not getting, you know, giving that money back to the employees who are working in their companies. And that's certainly a demographic that was already there that Bernie Sanders then capitalized on and spoke to.
So, but is that a sentiment that you're describing that exists in, you know, possibly parts of the conservative leaning tendencies? Because you seem to have a very good grasp on that sentiment. You're describing it almost as you share it, as if you share that feeling.
I don't know.
Okay.
I am 26 years old, so I live in that environment. Mm. The millennials are the generation that's propelling Sanders to these enormous victories, I think, at least from what I've heard. No, I am a rather successful entrepreneur, built the business, that kind of thing, went the whole nine yards there. But what I see is still that disenfranchisement with the right. with the American dream. I think personally that, you know, there is an aspect of the economy that could change for the better. Like you said, it's capitalism. It has worked incredibly well. You could improve it. You know, probably it doesn't make sense for CEOs to make $14 million a year for the employee that's working in the same company to make $725. That doesn't make sense.
Okay, so you do share parts of that sentiment. That's
right. So
yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think that there are problems, but I think that, you know, what Sanders is pitching, which is this total overhaul, tear everything out, I think that's modeled anyway. He's probably that's probably not his intention, but that's what is being proclaimed that he's going to do.
That's what he's selling, but it's probably not what he would do if he was actually in office or what he could do. But
you would hope. You would hope. It's definitely what some people want him to do. It's definitely what I don't know about a majority, but many of his supporters want to happen is a total overhaul.
Well, it's his base. It's his base, society. Right? It's the base that it's propelling him now, and it's like he's going to have to widen a little bit. Yeah,
just like the base of Trump supporters, literally wanted all of the Hispanic immigrants who were illegal to be deported immediately. Like, there was a base of Trump supporters that wanted that to happen. Yeah. It's not the majority, but it's the base. It's a base.
Okay.
Franco? Yeah, I was just going to say that listening to you talk, Alex, I would say that maybe a better alternative to beat Trump would be not Sanders, but one of the other, Bloomberg or Peter Buttigieg, in the sense that since they have gone left a little bit, but there's still sensible Republicans who are aware of the inequalities and the issues at hand, I would assume that they are the most, prepared to just make the ones that voted for Trump last time some to cross into the Democrats and say, okay, they're not as crazy as Sanders. I mean, of course, I'm repeating an argument that anyone can make, right? Not as crazy as Sanders, still reasonably sellable. I don't know.
But that's Alex really was saying. That. Yeah. Go ahead,
that's,
Alex.
That's really true, Franco. I've heard that with many of my clients that, you know, they love the economy. They love, if they keep saying over and over again, if Trump was not such an asshole, and sorry if I can't curse, but if he was not such a prick, he would be one of the best Republican presidents that have existed in the last 30, 40 years, right? He's done great for the Republican Party and the Republican values from a strictly policy standpoint, but he is such a prick that I have heard people say, even with all that, with what I wanted, seeing that happen, I would still think about voting for a Democrat if they just hadn't put up Hillary Clinton or if they just didn't put up Bernie Sanders. Hmm. There was definitely that sentiment.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to refrain from talking about Clinton again. He was demonized in a way that is, you know, anyway. So, yeah.
She earned a little bit. At least,
a little bit. Yes,
you can't blame everything on the news media. You have to take responsibility for something.
I think she earned it. She had some missteps, but not to the extent that sentiment. She earned criticism, but the I would never vote for her no matter what.
Yeah,
I don't even think she earned the criticism. I think she was. I mean. Well, she's criticizable as any politician is criticizable. I mean,
That's fair. I don't think she should have gone to Lehman Brothers and you know, get paid to do speeches, for example. But that's not what was necessarily being leveled against her. But anyway, all right. Let's not remake that old election. But
yeah,
we're going to move on. This is really interesting. I didn't realize actually that Sanders was the front runner. And
maybe it's because Bloomberg is aiming for Super Tuesday, which is next week, I think.
Yeah,
so
it's possible.
There's still the chance that next week everything changes.
Yeah, we Americans got to watch a public execution on the first debate that Bloomberg participated in. He was publicly executed. I don't know who was there at the South Carolina debate, but he was killed on stage.
Really?
It was amazing.
Really? What happened? What was his failing?
He was attacked. You know, it really did seem like arrogance. He was attacked by every single other candidate. And while he was ready for some, and, you know, Bloomberg does have this way of rolling with the punches in some ways, he was not ready for a lot of the assaults that were levied at him. Warren threw some particularly sharp barbs, and I think his polling plummeted. And that's sort of one of the things that allowed Bernie Sanders to, again, it's the same thing that happened in 2016, as far as I can see.
That's exactly what you were describing. All right, we're going to move on to South America. But I can't resist asking you what you think of Trump, because we get a few conservatives on this show every once in a while, but there's always this sentiment. There's this tendency for other people to paint all of the conservative people with the same brush. And I wonder, you know, where you stand about Trump specifically, what you think of him.
You know, as I said when I started out, I am fiscally conservative, but I am socially more liberal than probably your average conservative on the street. Mm-hmm. Although in the East Coast, I see more and more people who are like that. Trump is a right asshole. He is just a really, I would never, ever invite him to dinner. I would not allow him into my house. But he is also, like I said, from the viewpoint of a Republican who has Republican values, which are not invalid just because you don't believe them, right? Just because someone else from another party doesn't believe them doesn't make them invalid. Those, for someone who has those values, he is one of the best presidents from a policy perspective that we've seen, right? So I do not like the guy. I voted for my mom in the 2016 election, just like Justin Robert Young did. We had sort of this like brain connection or something. I wrote in my mother's name. But as you know, from the perspective of what his policies are, he's done a great job from as a Republican president, and I personally think that if the conservative party didn't have such a vice grip on the electorate of the Republican nominee, and if he was able to pander to a little bit of different audiences, we would even see him be a little more humanitarian than he has been during his presidency.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Maybe.
He's an entertainer. He knows how to work the crowd, and he's working. It is not Donald Trump that is the issue there. It is, you know, there is the electorate that he is pandering to that wants that to some degree.
All right. Well, I'll just let your comment as is, and I won't push it further. All right, Franco, what's happening in South America?
Well, as we were saying, there's most importantly, what's not happening is the coronavirus, which is good, and just luck, I guess. I've been trying to read and ask Colombian friends and Brazilian friends about what was happening in their country specifically. And well, I guess another thing that was not happening in a way is the protests that were very present, and I think it were really internationally recognized at the end of last year. I don't know. I don't know if that got into the news. I think.
Oh yeah. It got in France, into the Phileas Club. We talked about it at length, about both of them at length with specials. So yeah.
So it's yeah. I mean, it's not as if everything's over, but at least, well, there's no, the protests have calmed down in a way. When discussing this, some maybe 1 month ago or so, with some friends, I think one mistake people did about this mass protest, and just to be clear, protests were at the same time in Colombia, Bolivia, well, Venezuela, we can consider it a country where the protests are constant, but also in Chile, very strong protests, and in Ecuador. So, there's no common one mistake people do, I think, especially here in France, where we're discussing this, is that to group the whole continent into one thing. I think it's a very easy thing to say. Oh, the country is mad in general, or
right. The whole continent is mad about the same thing.
Exactly. There's an issue that's common to all these movements. I mean, I guess there's some kind of contagion in the sense if you see that the other country is protesting, of course, maybe you are more inside to do it. But each one has had its particular reasons. I would say that maybe the most common thing around it was the fact that the commodity prices have been going down, or have been down in general, have been low in terms of, and Latin America in general depends a lot in be it oil, copper, gold, whatever you name it, and if prices are low in general, or companies have less money and they cannot, and there's more unemployment, or the government, if it's the government that extracts the resource, in some countries it is, you know, it has less money to spend on things, or you know, to, it has to raise prices, for example, whatever. So it is true that there's this one thing, one common thing, that, and sadly it's gonna get worse, because this Brazilian friend was telling me now that with the coronavirus, China is buying less things, and I guess it was also the trade war in the previous months, and so China is the, I think, number one buyer for or trade partner for many of the big countries in South America, at least. It was USA, and now they compete depending on the country. But if China goes bad in some way or another, the continent suffers definitely, because the prices go down, because they buy less stuff, they build less stuff, and they need less, I don't know, copper or gold or whatever. So yeah, in this context, you know, there's the one thing is these protests have been going on. Another thing that's going on little by little is that this, I don't know if you know, it was named the Pink Tide at some moment, and it was in the 2000s, so 20 years ago already. It was that there are several countries, in especially South America, but some in Central America, were turning left, and the leader of this movement was, of course, Hugo Chavez. In Venezuela, but many countries turned left into they called it 21st century socialism. So it was Venezuela, Ecuador, Argentina, Brazil with Lula and Uruguay also, which has been always been left. And nowadays, not all, but most of those countries have been turning right. So now we're in I guess it goes in waves.
Yeah, it's all with the populism wave, essentially, and they, yeah, it's true, they're all in that movement, or almost.
Yeah, I mean, there were populists on the left, and now many are populists on the right. So, for example, in Brazil, we have Bolsonaro.
Right.
And there's, you know, there's all these other countries like Chile and Peru who've never been nor extreme left nor extreme right, have always been more right than left, but you know, more or less in the middle, who have, at least for the last, I don't know, 20 years, that have been staying on a little bit, you know, without, well, Chile had this mass protest, but besides that, they have been going on more or less stably. But yeah, I it's interesting to see how the, you know, these things that come in waves. You know, now we're in the more, you know, right wing part of the wave, and it's going to be interesting to see how people react to this.
Now,
I have a question, Franco, if I could ask. What, when you're saying right, is it still sort of the same thing that we would talk about in like the French right, or is it more like the American right?
That's a very good question. Depends on the country, actually. For example, in Peru, right now we have liberal party, in the sense that it was conservative economics. In terms of economics, it's conservative. In terms of social rights, well, let's say social rights, naming, for example, abortion or minority rights, etc., quite liberal, in the sense that they supported these things.
Damn, I need to move to Peru. Are you that's a party?
No, that's the problem also in Peru. Parties don't last long. I mean, they get created every 5 years, more or less, between coalitions of things. And so there's some parties that last long, but they're not the best parties, unfortunately. For example, the current president was actually the vice president. Now I'm talking about Peru. Because the last president had to resign because of corruption allegations. I mean, in terms of politicians, I think Peru is not the best example. All of our politicians are or in jail or dead or being prosecuted, being searched for. I mean, but literally, I mean, all living politicians are or in jail or being looked by the authorities. There's one who is in California. If you find him, please send it back. But yeah, I mean... and just it is that as absurd as it sounds. So one of our past presidents commit suicide last year when the police went to his house to catch him. Is that
not a good sign?
Wow, that is not a good. Although one might argue that the American politicians are just better at hiding their crimes.
I don't know.
Or
I mean,
maybe better able to.
For all the bad that there is in Western democracies and the criticism we levy towards our politicians, you know, when you look in other places, and that's one thing which I have an issue with how capitalism and our democracies are being criticized today. It ignores a lot of the good that the system does, and the anti-system movements, while I understand them, I'm very afraid that they mischaracterize the reality of the situations, and they throw the baby with the bathwater. And what you just said, Alex, even though it was in jest, I think is a reflection of that, because there's a lot of anti-corruption in, anti-corruption systems in place. And of course, not everyone is Sweden or Finland in that regard. And there is some fudging. But it's not as bad as people think it is, and the government is not as inefficient as people say it is, and all of that I think is actually doing a disservice to the entire population, and people do a disservice to themselves.
In fact, more to the point, I would say Peru, even if I complain and make jokes about it, is not doing that bad. I mean, the last 30 years we have had constitutional issues, presidents that tried to stay too long and so forth, but we have just managed to like put the ones that should go to jail and I have like a very good economic development. Actually, I mean, Peru is a lot better now than 10 years ago and then 20 years ago and then 30 years ago. I mean, and it's something that happens everywhere. In Peru, people complain still, and they don't realize that compared to even other South American countries, we're not doing that bad. I mean, There's also a reason why there's so many people from Venezuela that come to Lima and Peru in general, and that's another whole different issue. Even if there's a lot to complain in Peru, we are doing more or less good. I mean, I would say that of course we're not in a European level of development, and it's still very long after we'll get there. But it's something that you can see, and I can see it in when I was there. I was for a month on December to January, and the prices, for example, of things are not as cheap as they were once. And people have smartphones everywhere, even the one people who work in the field, for example. So it's one of those things that maybe. If you look every day, you don't realize it. But if you think like 5 years or 10 years ago, it's really a dramatic change. So you can depends on what you do, of course. But it's not really that bad. And what I was saying about the Venezuelan, that was another issue. Is that another thing that I've got to learn while I was there? I mean, I've heard it all the time, because of talking to friends, talking to people like in Peru, and I've been there. You know, it's been going on. The Venezuelan migration has been gone for years, so it's the thing that I've always heard. But this time it was even worse, in the sense that many people, and I would say mostly middle class people in Peru, have this aversion to Venezuelans, in the sense that they are convinced that they are criminals.
Really?
And, I've never heard that before.
And in fact, one of the phrases I've heard is, you know, the first ones who got out of the country at the beginning went to Colombia, to the United States, or the ones with the money, they went to the richer countries. And now the ones who got to Peru were the poor ones and the criminals. Like, we got the last tail of the migration, you know, and then we got the bad ones.
So there's racism everywhere, is what you mean.
Right. I mean, they're sending murderers. They're sending.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not even racist.
They're not sending their
best.
It's
the same thing.
No, but I mean, but, racism, obvious, you know, like
discrimination in a way. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's sad because I was listening to a TEDx talk that was done in Peru last year, where there was a Colombian presenting the facts, actually, in statistics, and there was no statistic that would show that there were no criminals were more likely to be Venezuelans or Venezuelans were more likely to be criminals.
I mean,
in Peru.
We should know by now that the facts don't matter as much as we think they do or as we would want them to. And being surprised about that 4 years ago was understandable and the reasonable reaction. Being surprised about this today, I think...
It's just naive.
It's not just naive. It's idiotic. If we are still surprised that facts don't move people and don't convince people as much as they should, we are being obtuse. Like, the fault is on us now. We would like to change that. Maybe we would like to make it so people understand and internalize facts better. But if we're still surprised that they don't, we're the ones being dumb. We're the ones being morons. Sorry, not morons,
in fact,
idiots.
No, I understand, but in fact, since I heard
don't
it
say
that
fact.
Much...
Don't say fact. Facts don't exist anymore. No, sorry, go ahead.
Just because I heard it so much... Mm. I started to question the idea of maybe they're right. I mean, why should I know better? I mean, I started questioning the fact itself. I mean, I was thinking maybe they're right. Maybe there are more criminals that are Venezuelans, and I don't really know. Maybe this is the truth. I mean, I guess there's some study somewhere which would be easy to check, but.
I think that, like, independent of that issue, you know, we should always do that, right? I think that the Democratic Party, especially right now in America, at least, you know, you see that problem that you're describing right now, which is they're not doing that, and you know, it's gonna hurt them probably. But we all should do that. We should say, well, maybe the other side, maybe my bias is leaning me toward. I mean, I don't think it's true on your, you know, in that specific, it's very unlikely that like a whole race of people or a whole culture of people are all criminals. But
I mean, yes, to be clear, in that case, I think not just in that case,
probably
in
not,
all cases,
right?
The facts that the okay, I'm going to stop saying facts. No, I'm going to keep saying facts. The fact that facts don't convince people doesn't mean that facts aren't facts and aren't real, right? So this case, the TEDx talk, the TEDx talk that you were talking about, Franco, that was showing the data and showing the fact that that is in fact not true, I don't dispute that. I think it's important to understand that this is reality. But, the fact that facts don't convince people, don't change the fact that facts are facts.
I think the problem gets more gray, and I don't know how much we want to dig into this, but the problem gets even more gray when you find out that statistics are statistics, and they're not, you know, they enlighten us to certain parts of truth that we might not have otherwise seen, but they do not show us the truth. And especially the way that the statistics can be presented. We know that on Fox News, they present them in one way. CNN, they present them in another. It's the same exact data. It's just how it's spun. So,
well,
you know,
I would argue it's not the same exact.
Itself.
I would argue it's not the same exact data. It's chosen and picked. And when you're on a 24-hour news channel, yes, you can make the numbers say whatever you want. When you're making a presentation from an expert and a scientist who has, you know, a mastery of that topic, then you should trust them a little bit more. Not blindly and not, you know, there are some things that aren't maybe completely objective, but there are some things that are factual. And now I'm defending facts after having railed against them.
Right.
Understand, I wasn't railing against facts. I was railing against the idea that people would still be surprised that facts aren't enough to convince people. And that's the lesson here. Facts still exist and are still real. They can be massaged. But that's always been the case. You know, that there's always been a way of presenting truth that favors your view or the other person's view. That's the whole job of a politician to do that.
How much of that, though, is the fact that we don't actually know what the truth is for the most part in these contentious issues?
Yeah, well, that's for many of these issues. But for example, if you talk about, you know, healthcare, I was going to say climate change, but
right.
That's an easy one. If you talk about healthcare, the obstination of America to make it work a certain way is factually detrimental in almost every metric for almost every part of the population.
We pay way more as a country, as a society, and as an individual than we would for the worse healthcare because of the way our system is set up. That is absolutely true.
Yes. So that is one example.
There's 20, 30 years of data to back that up, for sure.
Exactly. So that is an example of a factual truth that is difficult to dispute, but that is being disputed by some. But
sure. Anyway. Yeah. And I think that you're probably what people see is, oh, no, the healthcare system is fine. And what's actually being said is, no, I like the way the healthcare system is because I can get to my doctor at my time and choose my, you know, that kind of thing. Mm. And I don't have to wait in line for 6 months and all this kind of stuff. That's the thing that's being marketed.
You know, there are systems which work. Take the best of both worlds, as is the one in France, for example. We can go to
and
any
hopefully
doctor.
Hopefully we'll get there one day. Hopefully.
Yeah. All right. Anything you want to add as a conclusion, Franco, to the South American part of the conversation?
Good question. I just hope that, my best hope for South America or Latin America in general is that just not destroy it, so ask for any politician to just not destroy what there is and just let the country like be itself for a while. I think that's what we did with Peru, and it more or less worked. So I fear change the whole system. I don't know, that's what I fear the most, maybe.
Is Peru the most functional / successful country on the continent at this point?
No, okay. We are maybe an example of recent years, but I think that if you ask me, the one everyone, there's two options, be it Uruguay or Chile. Mm. Uruguay is small, so it doesn't count as much, sadly. But it's really an example of good politicians. They've been mostly on the left, but now they're on the right, I think. But mostly doing, you know, good policy and not trying to change everything or trying to destroy what they have. And it's been doing good. I mean, not excellent, but it's just a good example of a good running country. Mm. And Chile, that depends on whom you ask, it has been a really right-wing country, even though there's been left-wing governments. I mean, you could argue it's been very similar to the U.S. in terms of how it's been being run since the 90s, since the end of dictatorship. And they have like grown, they were right-wing even in the dictatorship, of course, and they have been growing very, very strong for a long time. And they're like, you know, we Peruvians envy the Chileans because of many reasons, not only because they're rich, but everyone sees the Chileans as, they are the rich ones. Mm. And in fact, that's something I wanted to say. When they were saying, oh, you know, the Chileans are protesting just like everyone else in Latin America is protesting, so they're not as good as they were. That's the thing I heard in France. And I, and it's my opinion, definitely. I see that the Chilean protests more like the French ones, actually, in the sense that it's middle-class people that think that the system is not fair, which it isn't in almost in general, more than people fighting for democracy or people fighting for their rights to be respected, or, you know, for shameless things done by politicians. Mm. It's more the issues that Chile has are more of a rich country issues, more than like, you know, the rest of the South American issues, which are really poor people or
developing
injustices,
type
or, you know, corruption.
Of,
Yeah. Doesn't mean they're not important. It's just that they're in a different level, you know, of importance.
What you're saying is it shows kind of that the country is more successful, actually, not that it is less successful or as, yeah.
It seems to lend credence to what you were saying, Patrick, which is about, like, capitalism and how the politics, at least in America, and what you're talking about with the French left, where they want to totally upend the system, and it's because they don't see all the value that the system gives them, because it's sort of it's taken for granted, basically. The undertone, right? We all have a TV in our house, we all have Netflix and all this kind of stuff, and it's, you know, that's great, but it's not something that's seen as this is there because of our capitalist economy and all this kind of stuff.
I love it when people agree with me, so thank you, Alex.
I'm glad we said we were all entrepreneurs, because now it seems that we're all supporting capitalism, so at least the bias was announced beforehand.
At the beginning. Yeah. I mean, again, it doesn't mean there aren't things that should be fixed. And I think some of the things you mentioned, Alex, like the income inequality, especially in the US, I think it's less so in Western Europe, because we have a lot of social safety nets that level the playing field that are important. But in the US, for all the great things that the economy is doing, the working poor is like when I go to the US, it is visible anywhere I go.
It's extremely transparent. And there are people here who put blinders on and don't really see it, but it is palpable how different the life is of someone who's even upper middle class, not a billionaire or anything, and someone who is just working, you know, two or three jobs. I mean, I've been there. I worked at Cracker Barrel. I was a dishwasher. It is a totally different life. And it is very easy to see how someone stuck in that position with no real way out could become very angry and want to just throw the whole thing out, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's not, you know, the same in, not that there isn't poverty in France, obviously there is, but
sure.
At least, I guess what I'm trying to say is, at least when you're poor in France, you get some help from the government. I guess you do in the US as well. It's unfair to say you don't. But you also get like free education, healthcare. Like, no one is bankrupt because of student loans in the West. And that kind of thing, when you see that situation, when you look around you, all of your friends are basically have taken a loan on their life to study. It feels extremely unfair. And I think it's not wrong to feel that way.
But. Well, and you've got that, but you've also got the fact that we have a history, even up until like the 90s, and some might argue even up until today, of you know, sort of demonizing 30 or 40% of our society that makes up the vast majority of the, you know, lower socioeconomic class, which is people who have, you know, darker skin than white people do. Mm. So you have that on top of there's inequality. There's also this sort of racial prejudice of older generations. And there's on top of that, this history that weighs on people who are in those demographics. And it, you know, I can't even imagine what that's like, but it would seem to affect your psyche. There's no way it couldn't, right?
But I'm not even talking about that. Like, student loans, like, quote unquote,
I'm
rich
saying on
white
top
kids
of the student loan
on top
thing,
of that,
right?
Yes,
even
right,
on
right.
top of that, you've got this other dimension of socioeconomic inequality that is, you know, Compton, California, or is, you know, downtown Atlanta. And you know, south of downtown Atlanta, and those things make it even more complicated than just, you know, you've got kids who have a lot of student loans.
Yeah. You wanted to say something, Franco, and we'll end on that. I'll give you the last word.
Nice. I was going to say that just that getting the two sides, I think Latin America in many ways, I've always been in some way in the middle, trying to be like the US in some ways, or in some countries, or in sometimes in some governments, and sometimes trying to be like Europe in other times. So it's like a mix of experiments trying to run one and the other. So far, I would say that the ones that follow the US have worked the best. Doesn't Weird. Mean that it's going to be like works. It. But yeah, I mean, and it's still going on. I mean, it's like the debate has always been and it always is in every each country whether we should increase the minimum wage and try to get more social security or social rights to people in general and try to protect the ones that are worse off. And with a small country that's not rich, it's hard, but you still have to do it. At the same time that you try to manage business growth and try to get foreign investment so you have more employment. So it's, I think in Latin America, it's one of those debates, eternal debates, as well as anywhere else, I guess, of mm-hmm. whether we should follow more the US in trying to let's be rich and then try to get the social things, or let's try to include the poor in the development so we grow in a more equal country, you know? I mean, yeah.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was with you until you said the ones that followed the U.S. succeeded more. I was like, oh, obviously we're better. But, oh, damn it. All right. And that is a good point to end the show on. Thank you very much to both of you for being on. It was lovely having this conversation with both of you. Do you have some social accounts? So, Franco, I remember that last time. You gave us your Google Plus account, which I guess you
I don't
were
have
that
it anymore,
lone voice.
Sadly. Yeah, they took it away from me.
Uh huh. So
yeah,
do you have
something
else?
I guess my online presence now is reduced to, you know, it's I'm gonna just do publicity. I'm starting this company that's called hackpackinglife.com.
Okay, hackpackinglife. So
hackpackinglife.com, and it delivers everything everything for travelers. You know, it's the perfect traveler kit. Right now, it only works in Peru for people who go to Peru. So yeah, that's what has been keeping me busy so far last I don't know, 6 months.
All right.
So if people are going to Peru, I mean, it's unlikely, but if they want to visit the site, yeah, be my guest.
Hackpacking Life. All right, I'll put the link in the show notes. What about you, Alex? Do you have a Twitter account or something like that?
Yeah, I am on Instagram. I'm not active, but you know, you can follow me and maybe I'll post every once in a while. amitchell.coach, or I'm sorry, amitchellcoach. I don't think there's a dot there. And if you have any questions or if anyone would want to email me, it's amitchell.coach@gmail.com. I'll go ahead and pimp the company I'm currently working to build, which is the Medical Empowerment Center. We're in North Atlanta, and we're trying to provide strength training services, but also counseling and you know, medical consultation and things like that for people who have who are undergoing treatment for cancer or Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. Because these sort of more holistic therapies are really, really important for those populations, as well as just people who are 50 and over and, you know, trying to stay young. So I'll definitely put my name in the hat for that.
All right. So I will follow you, and please ask you to stop making me look bad because I just do podcasts and you do awesome things for people. That is really
we're trying
cool.
to.
Well, doing podcasts is awesome too, Patrick.
Oh, thank you. I
really admire your podcasts. They're really good.
I listen to no other world news podcast.
Thank you. But you know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm approaching 50 slowly, but surely, more quickly now that I have a kid. So maybe if you do consultations via Skype, I might, you know, engage your services because...
Let's make it happen.
My back is not what it used to be.
It never is unless you train it, you know. Yeah. Time does do that. And, you know, I will say a lot of the stuff that you hear about age-related degeneration is more like civilization-related degeneration. It has nothing to do with age.
Mm. So you mean like it's because we, the way we live?
It's because we sit down, you know, 60% of
you
the
eat
day.
Too many croissants, Patrick.
Yeah, we have all the calories we'd ever need. And
now you
we don't really have to walk.
Yeah, so it's really, so all I have to do is use my stand-up desk twice a day and my problems will be fixed, is what you're saying.
You'll never experience pain again, Patrick. You'll never experience pain. You'll be wealthy beyond your wildest dreams. It'll be great.
You know, the back pain I'll take, but everything else I already am lucky to be doing what I'm doing and to have the life I'm having. So I wouldn't dare ask for more. I'm incredibly happy already. So, and also, I'm going to Japan next week, hopefully. I'm leaving in 2 days, and the little one was sick, and now we're sick from what we had. Yeah. And I'm like, how is that going to work? We'll see, I guess. We don't have a fever. Yeah, no, I know, but we don't have a fever. So that's the important thing, right? That's what matters. We'll see. Maybe I'll be quarantined in a Japanese airport for 2 weeks. Hopefully not.
That's fun. What a fun trip.
Yeah, indeed. But if you want to see pictures from that trip, whatever it ends up being, either the inside of one room or actual Tokyo, you can follow me on Instagram. I'm not Patrick over there. I'm also not Patrick on Twitter and Facebook. I have the links in the show notes. And even more importantly, you can support the show on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link is also in the show notes. It takes about 2.5 minutes to support, and it helps enormously. You can make this show, it is you that makes this show happen. So thank you very much to those who already support it. And if you don't, if you've been listening for a while, maybe, you know, consider giving a little bit of money, throwing a buck our way, so that we can keep doing it. Thank you so much. And oh yeah, if you want to comment, frenchspin.com, if you have anything to add to our conversation. Thank you to both of you. Thank you to everyone who's listening. And we'll talk to you again in a few weeks. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.